This is the 50th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother John Popel on the topic, The King Who Fell. The subtitle for today is Solomon and His Bride. This is the second talk in his series. The introductory reading is Song of Solomon, chapter 3. We welcome Brother John.
Good morning, everyone. Good to hear such a strong response of good mornings. Everyone's still awake and engaged. This is excellent. So then, this is an exciting position to be in. I'm just describing my own personal experiences, and I'm aware that different people will feel differently about these ideas, and that's fine. But from my position, I had now reached the point where I could not place any remaining confidence in what I'd been taught this book represented, but I was in the exciting place where I now have a clean slate. I almost have a new book of the Bible to approach, and this is a wonderful position to be in. So just to reiterate the hypothesis that's going to, I don't start with the hypothesis that comes out of the evidence, but to reiterate the hypothesis that we're going to say, my theory is going to be actually very well represented by this photograph, and that's why I'm using it as the header photograph for this series. In fact, one of the teens was bright enough to know exactly where this photograph comes from and the history of it, but that's not important to us in itself. What's important is the fact that all we have is the idea of a woman leading a man down a path of false gods. The woman is not guilty. She knows no other god. In fact, she does not know the God of Israel. The man that she is leading, in the case that I want to interpret it, is King Solomon. And he does know God. In fact, he's probably had one of the best spiritual educations any human could have. He had King David as a father. So he is without excuse not to have enough love for the Lord God of Israel as to want to share that knowledge and that relationship with everyone that he meets. This then is the suggestion that I'm making. I find, to my surprise, that most modern expositors, and I'm outside of the Christadelphian community, I'm just talking about literary professors and whatnot, deny that Solomon is a character in the song, despite his mention on seven occasions, some of which we read when Brother Paul helped us with that reading. For example, King Solomon is a central figure in the lover's fantasies, says this professor, not a character in the poem. And similarly, an Anglican expositor will argue, the two lovers are every man and every woman, and they have nothing to do with Solomon. And King Solomon is not one of the characters of the song. Very clear declarations, yet the evidence provided for that is rather flimsy. But I don't want to dismiss it. I don't want to be arrogant and say, well, you know, professors know nothing at all, listen to me instead. I mean, I need to pay some attention to the fact that there's almost a unity of spirit to say this isn't really Solomon that we're dealing with. But let's look at what the evidence presents from the Bible. First of all, I should mention, I rely on these workers very heavily for the act of translation. If we're going from Hebrew to English, I'm just going to shut up and listen to them because they know about it and I don't, at least at expert level. However, we're now in the region of exposition. We have a reliable English text, and we're now trying to take it from English into actual spiritual meaning. And here I feel that perhaps the secular professors are not actually as familiar with their Bibles, because they make some quite plain mistakes. They're familiar with the language, and so I don't have any difficulty standing up to them in this region and saying, no, I think you're wrong. Let me show you just how that looks. On the left-hand column there, I've taken a number of verses, some of which we just read, from chapter 3, a number of verses that just suggest that we're dealing with a literal scenario of King Solomon and one of his literal brides, one with whom he was clearly very much in love. And I'm going to show you the example of this Anglican worker who's going to say, I don't think this is literally King Solomon. Look at the lengths to which he's driven to do that. Look, it is Solomon's carriage. And Gledhill will tell us, the two lovers are every man and every woman. They have nothing to do with Solomon. So there's a direct rebuttal, but without any evidence to suggest why Solomon's name should be essentially removed from the text. the king. And in Hebrew, the Hebraists are agreed, this is not a metaphor, this is not a symbol, it's the definite article. It's the king that's showing up in chapter 1. Again, he says, part of the royal fiction, the idea that these two lovers, who are generic and represent anyone, have just made up the idea that there's a royalty there. There's a banquet hall, again, one of the non-symbolic uses in the Hebrew, apuron, the idea that it's a physical place where, in fact, a king might dine. Perhaps in the girl's imagination, he suggests. And so at this point, I'm already getting to this point of, like, I'm not finding this reasoning very compelling and very evidence-driven. So I'm a little more comfortable to say, I'm not immediately taken to say that I must remove Solomon from the idea. Look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. And how do we get out of that? Well, apparently, we have distanced ourselves from the idea that a strong narrative thread can be found in the song. This enables us to avoid the difficult questions posed by the passage. And I'm thinking, well, that's a very surprising, even at just an academic level, never mind the Bible, just in terms of academic rigor, that is really quite a poor approach, I would suggest to you. So by this time, I'm more than comfortable to say I'm not following these ideas of needing to remove Solomon. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines. Many have tried to reconcile these numbers with Solomon's harem. Indeed, I will. But we do not need to be concerned with such matters. The reference is non-specific. So you now know that 60 is a non-specific number, and that 80 is a non-specific number. I'm sure there are specific numbers, but the number of minutes in the hour, for example, is quite arbitrary and unknown. And finally, that the female character is a prince's daughter, very much of the type that Solomon would have wed, of course. We are under no obligation to take it literally. Well, we're under no obligation to read the book in the first place, are we? I mean, if we don't want to do that. So I feel quite comfortable to say I think the arguments that try and remove Solomon from the text literally are really quite flimsy and surprisingly poor in academic rigor. So I'm comfortable to move forward and say I don't need to go down that arrow, that idea. If God were referencing Solomon, for example, what language would appear? In other words, if God wanted to tell us a literal story of Solomon, what language would appear other than precisely these sorts of things? If this doesn't justify Solomon appearing in the Song of Songs, then equally it doesn't justify Solomon appearing literally in the Book of Kings either, or anyone else for that matter. I mean, these are very literal mentions to my mind. So, look, it is Solomon's carriage escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, one of the seven mentions of Solomon in the book. Brother Whitaker said about 50 years ago now, he commented very directly in the testimony, apart from the title, Solomon's Song of Songs, six times the king in the story is called Solomon, so it seems absurd to attempt to change his identity. That was very direct words there from Brother Whitaker back in the testimony in 1967, and I tend to concur with that reasoning. And there's much more than this. Here's where it now becomes important, and we start establishing some real weight behind seeing the literal Solomon in the song, and we'll be doing something else at the same time. Here's where we're going to find some genuine cross-references that links the Song of Songs with the other parts of Scripture. Other parts of Scripture are going to be brought in to add weight to the fact that the song is part of a coherent storyline. It's not going to produce huge spiritual lessons at this stage, but it will a little further down the line. Understanding Solomon as the speaker, as the character in the poem, allows the metaphors that are implied to become genuinely meaningful. What do I mean by that? For example, I'm sure many of you, particularly living on an island, have been in an airplane. Is that fair to say? Most people have been in an airplane? Show of hands. Oh, almost all of you. New Zealanders are very good travelers. And you'll be familiar, therefore, with that wonderful accelerating thrust you get at takeoff. You know, I'm still a little boy at heart, I suppose. I really enjoy that. That's kind of fun. And I might use that, I might refer to that thrust of takeoff at some point, in a metaphor. But the only reason that I use it is because I know about it. I've been through it. I've experienced it personally. If you've never been on an airplane, I bet you've never used that or any other part of airplane travel as a metaphor we tend to draw our metaphors from our personal life experiences. That's my point. So whoever said this, whoever said, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses," logically had first-hand personal experience of Pharaoh's chariot's horses. That seems fair, does it not? Otherwise, why would you be drawn to make that reference? I'm not particularly knowledgeable about horses at all, and so they seldom appear in my language by metaphor. Of course, times and cultures change, don't they? It turns out that back in the day, saying, "Hey, honey, you look like a horse," was a really good line. So it's worth remembering that these things don't always remain the case, but there we are. Furthermore, let's look at this. Henna, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. If I put a piece of calamus in front of you, would you know what it was? I wouldn't have the faintest idea. In fact, I probably have to confess, I've certainly heard of henna, and I can recognize the smell of cinnamon. That's about it. Any of the others, you could put a twig or a clump or a bear, I don't even know where they come from. You could put them in bowls in front of me. I couldn't possibly identify which one is which. But whoever knew all these things were before them had experience enough to know about them. Here's something also very interesting. Calamus and cinnamon are non-native to Israel. So whoever is noting this observation is familiar with spices that come from outside of the boundaries of the territory in which the poem is written. Worth noting. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. Think about in what context would that comment become meaningful. Let's look at each of those three quotes in a little more detail and see if we can use the Bible to interpret itself. That's our true, I'm not necessarily a reliable source of information, but if the Bible is interpreting itself, we can have a great deal more confidence. Let's start at the top. Oh, isn't it a better idea? Let's start at the bottom. Let's remember the order of the slides. Good. 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but my dove, my perfect one, is unique. So again, there's quite a bit of culture shock going on here, because this man is giving praise to this woman by saying, of all the 140 women that I'm linked to, you're the best. Again, don't try this at home. Okay. So again, culture shock applies massively. But how can that possibly be a useful phrase? Let's imagine this is an entirely monogamous relationship between two people in a rural village somewhere, and if he attempts to praise his bride by saying, of all the 140 women I'm linked to, you're the best, she's saying, you're talking nonsense. There are no other women in your life. So what kind of compliment is that? Is there a man anywhere in Scripture who is linked to multiple queens and multiple concubines? This is not a difficult question, is it? Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives, ultimately, of royal birth, and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. So if this comment is made by Solomon, it's meaningful, and the woman can extract, again, given the different cultural senses, can extract the praise from it that is due. If this comment is not made by Solomon, it's meaningless, it's empty. Solomon fell deeply in love with multiple queens and concubines. The rest of Israel's citizens did not. Pretty much throughout history, you might be able to find one other king somewhere with multiple wives, but already we're beginning to narrow down severely the number of people who could have made this comment in a meaningful sense. The next comment that we had, henna, nard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, myrrh, aloes. Someone knew what all of those things were when they were put before them. Who in the Bible is recorded as an expert botanist? Solomon. Solomon spoke about plant life, we're told, from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the walls. He knew it all, the entire spectrum. Now, this is where it's becoming very interesting. Look at that comment from 1 Kings 4. What spiritual value does that comment have? Little to none, I would suggest. So why is it in the Bible? We've found a use for it now. That's the verse that's going to help us identify and translate the Song of Songs. This is where the cross-references really come in. If we think Song of Songs somewhat drifts alone without any sort of anchoring within the broader scriptural canon, without that verse, we can't be sure that Solomon would have known these plants any more than you or I could have done, and I certainly couldn't have done. So this is where the Bible really takes into its own power its ability to self-translate. Never again were so many spices brought in as those the Queen of Sheba gave to Solomon. Ah, that's why we have non-native spices at the king's table. There was no cinnamon growing in Israel. I don't know if there is today, but there certainly wasn't then. But you can have cinnamon in Israel if somebody brings it in. Is there a verse that tells us that foreign spices came into Israel? Yes, at one time particularly. The time of the reign of Solomon. And suddenly now, 1 Kings 10, verse 10, has a role to play in explaining and translating for us the Song of Songs. This is the fabulous power of the Bible really taking on its own job as translator. Solomon possessed non-native spices, such as cinnamon, such as calamus. The majority of Israel's citizens did not. So this is a believable scenario in the reign of Solomon. It is not a particularly believable scenario at any other time or in front of any other person. And finally, I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariots' horses. Which Israeli had familiarity with Egyptian horses? Solomon. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kuwait, wherever that is. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. What's the value of telling us this? It has no spiritual import on its own, does it? I suppose it slightly fulfills the prediction that God made about what a king would do back in 1 Samuel 8. But other than that, these two verses also play a role. They say, if you want to know who the character is in the Song of Songs, read the rest of the Bible. I'll explain myself, says God's word. You won't need to trust anyone else. Solomon knew about Pharaoh's chariots and horses. The majority of Israel's citizens did not. So whoever made those three comments about mares, who knew about the spices, the 60 queens and 80 concubines, whoever made those comments had those life experiences. And the Bible itself, 1 Kings 10, 1 Kings 4, 1 Kings 11, has told us exactly and explicitly who that is that can make these comments and make these metaphors have the deep meaning that they need. The comments are only meaningful if they're uttered by one with the relevant experience, and the Bible itself has categorically identified who that is. It's Solomon. And so I think once we have these extra references, not only do we begin to anchor the Song of Songs within the canon, but we're now loaded with appropriate Bible knowledge that if we're challenged to say, no, this isn't really Solomon in the Song of Songs, we can say, well, hang on. I know verses that specifically identify the speaker of the certain metaphors that are given within chapter 1, chapter 4, and chapter 6 of that song. This is good, solid evidence. We're building a solid foundation now for where we're going. Solomon is the male character of the song. And what about the bride? Let's see if we can identify the bride also. The bride is from Lebanon. Consider the evidence. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Is it just that verse upon which I base it? By no means. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, looking toward Damascus. Yes, that's right, another culture shock verse. There's quite a few, aren't there? But this is the basis of the evidence that allows me to make the shock prediction. The bride is Lebanese. you know, Yogi Berra, the famous baseball player, is looking over our shoulder once more and saying, you can see a lot by just looking. There's quite a bit of evidence here that we are dealing with a girl from Lebanon. And I haven't cherry-picked these verses. That means to say there aren't other verses that suggest she's from somewhere else, and I've left those out because they don't fit my theory. These are all of them that suggest her origins, and they all point towards one and the same place. Notice again, I don't wish to be negative, but notice again, that does present a very great difficulty if we want to understand the bride as spiritual Israel. That doesn't work, does it? Because Jesus' bride, of which we all hope to be part, could be expressed in two different ways. We can either say she has one nationality, and she's Jewish, she's Israeli, spiritual Israel, or we can say she has 100 or 200 different nationalities. She's from every country in the world, just like this room full of people will represent a variety of different nationalities. What she can't be is one nationality that isn't Jewish. She can't be Russian. She can't be Turkish. She can't be Lebanese. So again, we have good confidence that we're following the right path here. The bride is from Lebanon. And this now has, now we start to begin to lean into a more moral or a more spiritual framework, and in a darker sense. This is not someone who knows Israel's God. And so she's not now becoming guilty, but she is becoming dangerous. She doesn't know Israel's God, and Solomon is falling deeply in love with her. Remember who Solomon is. He is the designated spiritual leader of God's people. That's what king really means. That's what king is supposed to mean. The designated spiritual leader of God's people. She is foreign. She is not, therefore, a daughter of Jerusalem. So now we understand why other characters in the song are called the daughters of Jerusalem. She is presented in counterpoint to the daughters of Jerusalem. There is the Lebanese bride, and by contrast, there are the daughters of Jerusalem, from whom Solomon perhaps would have been wiser to select a bride, or at least introduce his Lebanese bride to the God of Israel and convert her as a proselyte. So there is tension because of her different nationality. Not because this is a racial tension, it's a godly tension. Do you know God or do you not know God? This creates a tension because of that between her and the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, I've asserted that. Is there any biblical evidence? Yes, there's evidence directly from the song. She says so herself right at the beginning of chapter 8. If only you, Solomon, were to me like a brother, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you and no one would despise me. Which obviously has the implication that if I am publicly affectionate with you in whatever way is appropriate, I am despised. People don't approve of this relationship, and she's aware of it. She's perhaps not aware of why, but she's aware that she's being despised. So this isn't a happy picture. This is a tense picture that's developed here. And the basis of this despising, the basis of this tension, lies in the fact that he's not her brother. Obviously not in the literal sense, but in some sense they don't have that sibling relationship that would allow the relationship to be generally approved. She's not, in some sense, his sibling. And that, this is now, we're going to segue into a very difficult verse. I'm going to spend the rest of the time working with this verse. This is the verse that introduces her as the Shulamite. And even if you're looking down at your own Bible, you might see the word Shulamite given as the heading of her speaking many times. This is the most common name she's given by interpreters of the Song of Songs. When they want to refer to the female character, they call her the Shulamite more than anything else. Why do I deviate from that path? I deviate from that path because she's only named Shulamite twice and in the same verse, okay? Which isn't bad. I'm quite happy that she is the Shulamite. She's named the Lebanese bride a total of 9 times. So if it's fair to call her the Shulamite based on one verse, surely it's 9 times as fair to call her the Lebanese bride based on 9 verses. So I'm just going with the scientifically most supportable information. This, however, is her commonest name, the Shulamite. And who's speaking? you might think it's the male character. It's actually the friends or the observers, the general populace of Jerusalem who are speaking at this point. And they say, come back, O Shulamite. Come back, that we may gaze on you. Why would you gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of Mahanaim?" And I remember when I was first really enjoying getting my teeth into this book and I read that verse and I thought, well, that's fine. I'm never going to understand that verse. And that's okay, because I don't understand every verse, and some of them you just have to let go. And it was pretty clear to me at that time that this is one I was going to have to let go. I'll tell you why, for obvious reasons. As you've seen, my principal interpretive mechanism is to find other parts of the Bible talking about the same thing. Guess what? You're clean out of luck, right? Shulamite exists here and absolutely nowhere else in the Bible. So where are we going to go? And whereas Mahanaim does exist in other places, the dance of Mahanaim, forget about it. That's your one and only biblical reference. If you ever want to see some really wild ideas, just Google search the dance of Mahanaim online and look what people have dreamed up. That's really quite magnificent. But there's nothing else in the Bible one can find. So I was prepared to let this verse go. So it's somewhat to my astonishment that I now feel I actually have a grasp on what's trying to be said here. By the way, look at that last line, the dance of Mahanaim. Mahanaim is a proper name there. In your version of the Bible, whichever translation you're reading, you might have something different. Does anyone have two armies? Two camps, two companies, two groups, very fair. What's happened there is that they've translated the meaning of Mahanaim. Mahanaim means two companies or two groups or two armies. So they're not sure whether to transliterate the word as Mahanaim or to translate it as two companies. The Hebraist experts that I've gone with have said, no, this is supposed to be, given the inflections of the grammar, this is supposed to be a proper name. So we're going to run with Mahanaim, but that's why we're going to end up talking about the two companies anyway, so it's just a question of whether you have the name or what the name means. All right, let's see if we have any chance of breaking this down and going somewhere. What does Shulamite mean? Up to this point, all the six or seven Hebrew professors that I've been referencing have agreed on just about everything. Tragically, here they all decide to fragment and take different lines. Is it the feminine of Solomon? In other words, meaning Solomon's girl. Solomon and his Solomonites, as we might say in English. Solomon and his Shulamite. Yes, say some. No, say others. Great. That would be Shulamit, which of course is very difficult to distinguish between, particularly since many detailings of Hebrew omit the vowels or sometimes put in the occasional diacritical. So hard to know. Okay, we'll bear that in mind. The Septuagint is fascinating, because then you have a chance to access the Hebrew in an attempted Greek, and they record this as Salome. Well, that's interesting. We kind of know who Salome is, although that's not a biblical name. We know from Josephus' writings in AD 93 that this is the name of Herodias' daughter, the temptress who danced before King Herod to the point of seducing him and getting him to, basically, a beautiful woman who seduced and manipulated a king. That's interesting. Relevant, not relevant, I just put that out there, we'll consider that. And many make reference to Abishag the Shunammite. And you might say, well, that just isn't a fit. Shulamite is not Shunammite, it's close, but it's not a fit. We'll see, we'll just do a little bit of Hebrew culture of wordplay and see this is the type of thing that the Hebrews would do. All of these answers have plausibility. They all have pluses and minuses to them. Let's just leave them all wide open at the moment and close nothing off, see where we can go. Something relevant about Abishag the Shunammite, this is of course David's last wife, is that she would be a contemporary of Solomon's. She was a contemporary of Solomon's, we know this. And she probably would have been of similar age to Solomon. She was, it seems, a generation lower than King David that she married. So let's dig up some history. This is going to be very, very relevant. This is Solomon's early reign. "Please ask King Solomon," says Adonijah, his brother, "he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife." I need to back up. That's jumping in too late. Adonijah is a very reckless and a very foolish young man. He's Solomon's brother. King David is very old, and he has very nearly passed away. Adonijah has already made one effort to seize the throne. He's banded together with politically powerful personnel, declared himself king. But David has assembled Nathan the prophet and Bathsheba his wife and declared Solomon king. Public opinion is almost entirely with Solomon, and Adonijah realizes his life is on the line. And so he does the only sensible thing, and he throws himself at Solomon's feet and basically begs for mercy. Please spare my life. I'm sorry I did that. Okay, says Solomon, and spares his life. Adonijah, reckless fool that he is, spins right around. He's now talking to Solomon's mother, Bathsheba, and says, tell you what, can I have Abishag the Shunammite as my wife? Abishag the Shunammite is his stepmother. So he's violating the law and moral sensibility to start with. He wants his stepmother for wife. Why? She was a very beautiful woman, maybe that's part of it, and of course, that's still a very good linchpin towards arguing for the throne. Which of those desires was uppermost in his mind, I can't know. Please ask King Solomon, he said, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Adonijah just couldn't keep his head down and behave, and this time, it costs him his life. King Solomon swore by the Lord, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request. And therefore King Solomon gave orders to Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah, and he died. We have nice PG-rated pictures this morning. There we are. Just keep things good. So Adonijah is executed. Note the theme. Don't get lost in the detail. Note the theme. A royal prince is executed because he chose an inappropriate bride. And he's executed by Solomon. Solomon is judge, jury, and executioner, and I'm not criticizing his decision per se. But that's the stance we have in Solomon's own history. Interesting. And it's relevant here to introduce the Hebrew culture of wordplay. In English, we have the idea of puns, which are supposed to be funny. And the idea is you have one word which has two different meanings, and you use it in the context that it belongs for one meaning and imply the other, and thereby create humor. Hebrew doesn't do that. They do not have puns. What they do is they use similar-sounding words to create the same irony, best shown by example. What do you see, Jeremiah? This is in English, obviously. I see the branch of an almond tree. You've seen correctly, Jeremiah, for I am watching to see that my word is fulfilled. Meaningless and obscure in English. But the Hebrew is direct, and it introduces this wordplay. What do you see, Jeremiah? I see shaked. You have seen correctly, Jeremiah, for I am shakad. That's the idea. So God shows him a picture in a vision of something with a similar sounding name to what he's doing. I show you shaked because I am shakad. If you see it right, that's how the Hebrews have a word, that's how they create wordplay. It's not a pun, it's a different mechanism. I don't have a specific name for it. There's many, many examples. When Micah wishes to warn all the people of the land that judgment is coming, he says this, tell it not in Gath, in Beth Ophrah, roll in the dust. Those who live in Sarnan will not come out. In English, everything's lost, nothing has meaning. But for the residents of those cities, they will have something very memorable to take it away. If you look at the Hebrew, gad it not in Gath. In Beth Ophrah, roll in the Aphir. Those who live in Sanan will not tsar. Now you're going to remember that. Whatever hometown you come from, you've been given this wordplay to remember that bad times are coming. Gad, Gath, Ophrah, Aphir, Sanan, tsar. So this happens all over the Bible. We don't have time for more examples, but they're absolutely everywhere. As a consequence, therefore, we do have some weight behind the idea of Shulamite being a reference to Shunammite. In fact, I'm happy to incorporate almost all the suggested answers and saying what the crowd are trying to talk about is Solomon's Shunammite. The Shulamite Shunammite is effectively the Shulamite. He is making reference, I think, i.e. they're saying, Solomon, this is your Abishag. We've seen the Shunammite before. Come back, come back. Are we looking at the Shunammite all over again? Only this time it's Solomon's Shunammite, the Shulamite. And I think that's the clever wordplay that's going on. In fact, look at this. This is a detail from the NIV Study Bible. it says either a variant of Shunammite or a feminine of the word Solomon. In ancient Semitic languages, the letters L and N were sometimes interchanged, which immediately justifies any reading of Shunammite as Shulamite. Now, that's the icing on the cake. But for full disclosure, I must tell you, I have not been able to verify this statement anywhere else. I haven't been able to find any other academic source that says, yes, that's true. So I'm a little dubious of it, but it's absolutely perfect for my argument. I don't need it. I still have the cake, whether or not I have the icing. So what's the point? Here we are messing around with Hebrew letters and words. What's the point? Here's the point. This is an accusation of hypocrisy. Solomon executes Adonijah for desiring the wrong bride, and then himself desires and takes the wrong bride. Wait for it. 1,000 times. Right? That's pretty striking. Hence, come back, or deja vu, if you will. Come back, O Shulamite. Come back, beautiful girl, that we may gaze on you. Haven't we seen this before, Solomon? Now, why would we gaze on the Shulamite as on the dance of Mahanaim? Interesting. What's that about? Let's look at the legacy of Mahanaim. We have a few scriptures to turn up here, so that's good. We're going to have a good basis. Whilst there's no reference to the dance of Mahanaim, Mahanaim is something we know. It means two camps, two armies, two groups. And its legacy, I've summarized it very simply, is a house divided. Its origins are in Genesis 32. Esau is coming to meet Jacob. Jacob is terrified. Esau has forgiven Jacob for his deceptions, but Jacob doesn't know that. And Jacob thinks he's going to die and be massacred by the superior armies of Esau. In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into Mahanaim, at Mahanaim. So that he says, if Esau attacks, if my brother wipes out one of these parties, the rest of my family at least will get away. And there are two other references to Mahanaim where exactly the same thing happens. After Saul dies, Abner, the commander of the armed forces, takes Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, and declares him king. And he does it, guess where? At Mahanaim. David is declared king in Hebron, and the contrary dividing army, the contrary group, creating two groups and a divided household in Israel, happens when Abner crowns Ish-bosheth at Mahanaim. That's 2 Samuel 2. And we also have reference again at 2 Samuel 17. David, when Absalom revolts and rises up and say, I'm king now. So we have David king and his rebellious son Absalom king. We have two camps again. Where does David first flee? Perhaps he even knows what he's doing. He goes to Mahanaim. Says, look, Lord, we're two camps again. We're a divided household yet again. David flees first to Mahanaim. This reference to Mahanaim also has direct influence on Solomon's life. Not only because he was alive at the time of the rebellion, but the Bible tells us David talks to Solomon about this one. Do you remember that? Back to the early reign, the time of the execution of Adonijah, Solomon also executed Shimei. Why? Ultimately, that's why. King David said to Solomon, remember, you have with you Shimei, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Mahanaim. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. David says, you must now execute Shimei for his sins at Mahanaim. So this is the one time that Mahanaim is directly linked. It's spoken in Solomon's ear. And Solomon says in due course to Shimei, you know in your heart all the wrong you did to my father David. Then the king gave the order to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and he went out and struck Shimei down and killed him. So once again, we have an execution. Why? Because Shimei denigrated the throne of David at Mahanaim. Do you remember the event itself? Let's look it up so we know. This is actually a photograph of Mahanaim. And you see these kind of deep gorges. And we know that David, don't know which side he was on, David might have been on this side, fleeing from Absalom, fleeing from Jerusalem. And Shimei was on the other side of the gorge, remember? slinging mud and rocks at the royal party. Shimei pelted David and all the king's officials with stones. So David and his men continued along the road, while Shimei was going along the hillside opposite him, cursing as he went, throwing stones at him, and showering him with dirt. You might remember that this is what led Abishai to speak to David and delivered what, in my opinion, could be one of the greatest quotes of all time in all scripture, where he says, "One needs the King James for the glory of it. Why does this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head." It's a great quote. That was an aside. Anyway, Shimei is denigrating the throne of Israel by pelting the royal party with stones and mud, and that is what got him killed. We know that because David says that to Solomon, "Execute that man for what he did to me at Mahanaim." Israel's throne is denigrated. Again, the house is divided. Mahanaim is for real. David's fleeing retinue dodged the rocks thrown by Shimei. I have no idea what the dance of Mahanaim is, but I wonder, is it some ironic reference to the skipping and dodging and ducking that they had to perform probably for an hour or more as Shimei pelted them? That's my suggestion. I have no weight behind it. It's just something that I see. And now, Solomon denigrates Israel's throne by marrying the Lebanese Shulamite. The spiritual leader of God's people has allied himself with someone who knows no God. And in fact, in time, as we know, will go on to try and please all his wives by worshipping their gods instead, their gods who are no gods. And so then that, I think, is where we can wrap up this study. This is my final slide. There's quite a bit on it, and here's my interpretation in one word of what that call of the crowd is. It's an indictment. Solomon has married the Lebanese Shulamite, the very thing he killed Adonijah for doing, and has denigrated the throne of David and divided the house of Israel, the very thing he executed Shimei for doing. And so in the beautiful poetry, in the oblique poetry of the song, this is why the song is written by God. I don't think the people shouted this out knowingly. This is a poem written by God, and that's why there's more truth and more depth in these words than anyone at that time could have seen, I believe. Come back, O Shulamite. This is a return to the Shulamite days, isn't it? Come back, that we may gaze on you. And yet, why would we see the Shulamite in the same way we'd see the dance of Mahanaim? This is how. The Shunammite was the forbidden bride which Prince Adonijah improperly tried to marry. Solomon executed Adonijah for his crime. Mahanaim, the throne was abused and Israel divided, the kingdom divided by Absalom's rebellion, and abused by Shimei's specific personal attack. Solomon executed Shimei for his crime. Solomon duplicates the crimes of both Adonijah and Shimei. There's no doubt these are facts. Whether or not that's the translation of this verse, you'll have to decide for yourself. But these are facts, and they are facts all within the life of Solomon. So how interesting it is. Consider the weight of guilt that Solomon would bear for this hypocrisy. He's denigrated David's throne with the Shulamite marriage and divided Israel, the very thing for which he executed other people, including his own half-brother. And I think, therefore, that's some of the darkness. That doesn't put me off the Song of Songs. It makes me love it more. I think you love a book more when you feel you see more in it, whether it's happy and joyful or whether, as in this case, it's rather dark and indicting. But it's a powerful verse, therefore, chapter 6, verse 13, and that's my understanding of the reference to the Shulamite. So at this point, brothers and sisters, we've moved quite slowly, and I make no apology for that. It was necessary, I think, to perhaps clear a patch on which to build a theory, and by the end of talk number 2, we've done little more than identify, perhaps, the male character, the female character, Solomon and the Shulamite bride, and begun to see some of the interactions that operate between them. We're going to step up the pace from here on, and we're going to move a little bit more swiftly and really start to appreciating big blocks of the text and see how the dynamics work between the two characters. Solomon is the most powerful human on the planet. This is Israel's supreme time, and he's the king thereof. So unsurprisingly, he's the most powerful man around. And even this Shulamite, wherever she's from, is subservient to him. We're going to watch very fascinatingly as that dynamic completely shifts around. And it's recorded quite obviously and quite clearly in the song. I'm going to put the song's verses on the screen, so you'll get to decide for yourself whether I'm right or wrong about that, as Solomon eventually yields to the siren song from Lebanon. Thank you very much, Josh.